Well, welcome back. This is week number four, January 2024. It's the very first podcast that we are hosting this week. Last week we only did a newsletter, but this week we're back doing a podcast. We've got a thought for the week still that we're putting into the podcast. And this is going to be a general discussion around markets. And we're going to be doing exactly the same thing for the remainder of this year. Lots of stuff to chat about. We're going to talk about indicators just now. Dawn's written fantastic things on the Indian economy. We're looking at the SARB rates that have stayed steady at 8.25%, work from home, exports, and then we're going to end off by talking about global liquidity and what is happening with global liquidity. Now, just before we start, the Dow Jones index so far year to date is up 1.1%, the S&P 500 up 2.5%. Remember, for the year now, the S&P 500 is up 20.15%. And over 3 years is up 31.68%. Those are fairly significant numbers. Across in Germany, the DAX is up year to date 1.25%, and for the year 11.96%. Euro Stoxx 50 up 10.95% for the year. And we'll go back, if we just go a little bit shorter period of time, the year to date it's up 2.5%. We're going to be talking about the Indian economy, and I'll give you some of the numbers quickly for the Indian economy for the year. The index in China, I apologize, for India. You see how conditioned I am to talking about China, and there could potentially be a new winner here. So that is up 19.16%, and that is the year. And if one looks back on a year-to-date basis, there it is down 2.13%. Currencies, I mean, we've seen some strength as far as the rand is concerned. So the rand dollar at 18.79. Great British pound against the South African rand at 23.86, and the euro against the South African rand 20.39%. Dawn, you know what I find interesting? Because you start off by looking at the newsletter this week and just talking about the lackluster performance in the South African market. But it's interesting to note that US stocks have actually been outperforming emerging market counterparts for the last 16 years. That's a long time, right? US stocks are up 407% over this period versus emerging market stocks, which is a basket, only managed a return of 38%. Now, look, a lot of that is concentrated to the very large stocks in the American on the American market. I think if you compare the Russell 2000 here, which is a much more broad index, you're going to get a very different number. But it's just interesting to see the kind of activity that is happening in the US versus the rest of the world.
And I think, Kobe, I think it's pretty easy to determine what the difference is. And the difference is those big AI exposed tech companies that have had this enormous run up are just not found anywhere else. It's as simple as that. You know, we don't have it. Australia doesn't have it. The UK doesn't have it. They are pretty much concentrated in the States, with the odd outlier. There's some in China, there are a couple in Taiwan. But on the whole, this, you know, booming sector of the market that has been driving that market is found in the US.
And you need very deep pockets here, Dawn, in order to compete in this space. So you have counterparts, most of them are the United States. And then you have obviously components that are found in Europe. You've got components that are found in Taiwan. I think of Taiwan Semiconductors, which is really a manufacturer of semiconductors. And if you think about these deep pockets, this week in the Tesla results, it became evident again how deep your pockets really have to be able to play in the chip manufacturing space, and then by default in the artificial intelligence subspace. It's quite difficult. So really speaking, it's about the incumbents and how they slice and dice the market going forward. There's a lot of hype though in this space, Dawn, at this stage. NVIDIA is priced for, which is the poster child for this, is priced for absolute perfection. And if perfection occurs, NVIDIA is going to do incredibly well out of it. But if they falter in any way, the stock is going to be marked down. It's going to have to be, the multiple is going to have to change as far as that stock is specifically concerned. But there are other companies in that space. And look, and also, I mean, who are the people that make the money? It's not only the people that sell the chips. It is invariably going to be the people that can implement the chips and make the product a reality for their specific brand or for their specific company. And some of that stuff hasn't been priced in, I think, appropriately at this stage, if I look specifically at these quarterly results coming up.
I think we discussed that a little bit in the newsletter last week. We didn't have a podcast around it. Is that AI is great and it is what is driving this market, but the monetization of the AI is what is going to be crucial in terms of the future ability to get those earnings that these, investors are expecting from these companies.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a complex field, Dawn. It's a really complex. I mean, to understand, firstly, just chip manufacturing is a science on its absolute own. It is incredibly complicated. And then if you take complex chips into consideration, which is now artificial intelligence, these things, there's an evolution that is busy happening. And I think a lot of the market is hoping that it'll revolutionize what they are doing as as a specific company. It'll slash costs. It'll be a Nirvana type product. And the reality is that if I read a lot of well-known people that are talking about chip manufacturing and specifically artificial intelligence, you have people in the know, experts in the area. They're saying it's not this Nirvana moment. This evolution has been happening for a very long period of time, and there's little blocks that have been built on top of each other. And perhaps you have your Nirvana moment in a decade from now, but it's not going to be this wow moment that you just all of a sudden everything is just going to change overnight. Much of what is happening in the chip space is not artificial intelligence at this stage. It's basically chips learning methodology through what they call large language models, as an example, for instance, and then trying to understand how to behave in a certain way. Whereas, Dawn, you have what is called artificial intelligence. You're a human being. You are able to make up your mind based upon an information set that has been given to you. And that decision might be different given different input parameters. No, I suppose it's no different to artificial intelligence, but it's being able to decide that one outcome versus another one, but by just finitely changing one outcome or just changing the day, for instance. And that's what makes artificial intelligence. And I think that is still a while away. It's not going to be something that just miraculously changes the world tomorrow.
I agree, Kobe, but from an investor's perspective, I think this concentration of growth in a certain sector just emphasizes the importance of diversification, not just by sector, but by the location. That's why in our various funds, we have our Worldwide Flex Funds, which is a rand-denominated fund, so that investors can get that exposure. And so in the funds that we use in the retail environment and in the pension fund environment have exposure to this. And if you look right across the board in South Africa, it's those unit trusts that have a certain amount of offshore exposure that have managed to weather the storm, weather the sort of crawling sideways and drifting downwards in the terms of the South African market.
I mean, it's interesting because since the beginning of the year, where really speaking, large tech companies have continued to be buoyed and go higher, there's certain companies that I own in the Worldwide Flexible Fund, for instance, and they're great quality businesses. But if you just look behind the numbers and you see, like, for instance, year to date, some of them are down 8-9%, and you ask yourself the question why, but then you go look at the multiple and the numbers are good. And the earnings are coming through and they're great businesses. But if you look at the multiples, some of these things are trading with very frothy multiples, and they just can't sustain them. If you're trading off 40 times earnings or 45 times earnings, it is just too frothy for the market. Your earnings numbers have to become almost parabolic in order to justify that kind of valuation. And that's why these stocks have kind of hit the ceiling, so to speak. And from this point forward, either earnings increase dramatically in order to drive markets forward, or alternatively, markets are just going to continuously kind of stick at this level. And you might very well find that the S&P 500, 12 months from now is up maybe another 15, 18%, but that the Russell 2000 has joined that race and might be up 30%. And this would be kind of the rebirth of the mid-cap, small-cap company, and I'm expecting to see stories through the course of this year, kind of talking about, these companies were left for dead and look where they are now. I'm expecting to see some of those stories potentially making its way out. The other big thing is busy happening, and I've been seeing a lot of analysts talking about it, but I'm not talking about this year. I'm not talking about last year. I'm talking about it for the last 5 years. And that's the Indian economy and how it is potentially surpassing what is happening in China. And it really has got to do with policy, right, Dawn? I mean, you've written a fantastic piece on the Indian economy.
You know, Kobe, I've visited India. I spent 6 weeks in India, and India is the most amazing place, an incredibly unusual place, even for an African to visit. You think you have a concept of a massive population. I mean, I've lived in Rwanda, which has got the highest population, had certainly the highest population concentration on the African continent. But when you go to
Yes.
India and you've got these, what is it, 1.2 billion people. And I actually went from train from Delhi up into the north on a buying trip back in the noughties. And you know, you drive past farmlands, you know, just solidly for hours and hours. Obviously, they have to feed the population. But unlike
Yeah.
sort of driving from here to Bloemfontein, where you see farmlands and farmlands and cows and, you know, one homestead every 20 minutes kind of thing, here everybody's got their 1 acre and one cow and one hut. This is how they do it. They manage, obviously, there's subsistence farming going on, and but they do manage to, you know, sell into the market. But that sheer number of population, I didn't even get that feeling when I was in China. Obviously, in Hong Kong, it's different. Hong Kong is highly populated. But, you know, once you get into mainland China, you don't get this feeling of this massive population. And this is obviously what is we've been waiting for India to sort of, I suppose, as part of the education has to catch up so that they can start producing more than just sort of clothes and goods and rice and this kind of thing for export. And you know, they've got onto the tech track, as it were. Their population has become much more educated. I think this is a massive story potentially going forward.
I mean, the market cap of the Indian Stock Exchange has now surpassed Hong Kong. So India is now at $4.33 trillion as of Monday's close versus Hong Kong, which is at $4.29 trillion. That's rather interesting. The other thing that I find very interesting is that Indian entrepreneurs are, generally speaking, incredibly hardworking and incredibly smart. And they know how to, and within this environment, which really speaking is just an emerging market environment with no capital constraints attached to it, or very little capital constraints attached to it. And if one takes those things into consideration, this is free market or very free market, lots of skill, the ability to be able to implement, that is a fertile bed for what Schumpeter, which is the famous economist, would have called creative destruction. It's the ability for one idea, a better idea, to surpass today's great idea in order to create something wonderful. You know, Dawn, anecdotally, I'll tell you the story. My father-in-law, when he was at university in the United States, he had an Indian gentleman that went to university with him, and he had a dream of being in the microcomputer industry. And my father-in-law said to him, "Would you do this in the United States?" And he said to him, "No, I'm going back to India." And he said, "But why would you want to do that? You're now in the United States. Why would you want to go back to India?" And he says, "Because it can work there." And he has gone on to become a fabulously wealthy individual out of microcomputers. And I'm talking back in the 1980s and 1990s now, as the microcomputer, you know, had its advent. He really played a pivotal part in the Indian economy in order to make sure that these things are available, and just as a manufacturing hub, quite frankly, for microcomputers. So the environment is there. India is, I believe, going to play as an emerging market more and more of a pivotal role as the world economy shifts more towards India. I would say they would have a geopolitical agenda that's a lot more vanilla than what the Chinese agenda is. And I think that it might just be the beneficiary. You know, it might just be the beneficiary. If you're not looking at companies in India, and if you're not looking at the Indian economy, go and just pick up a book on India. Read about the economy. It is some fascinating stories that are coming out of that economy. So back in South Africa, I mean, the repo rate now unchanged at 8.25%, inflation at 5.1% year on year. It just feels like we're ambling on, Dawn. It's just another day in Africa, and things just amble on, and people are just trying to eke out a living. You know, today I was driving through a large portion of Johannesburg, kind of did a ring around Johannesburg. And you know, there's a lot of poverty, and I don't think the poverty alleviation is going to come anytime soon, you know, and there's the degradation of just a general infrastructure. I suppose what a lot of people are waiting for is, really speaking, a change at the ballot box, you know, a change, so to speak, from a, you know, from a ruling party perspective. But that's going to be quite difficult. I mean, I think most of the polls I saw puts the ANC somewhere kind of in the mid-40s, you know, maybe on the high end it's at 48 and at the low end it's at 44%. But at 48%, I'm pretty certain the ANC can still, you know, put a majority together with some minority parties, right?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a concern. I don't know whether I would prefer the ANC to have enough of a majority and to throw in a couple of smaller parties, or to, you know, get down into the low 40s and have to make a coalition with somebody like the EFF. Any, you know, coalition with the EF really worries me, and I think worries a lot of people. So, you know, kind of the devil that you know versus the devil that you don't. Well, I mean, I think we pretty much know what the devil is in the EFF, and they would be a kingmaker, and they would hold the ANC to ransom in order to push their agenda when it comes to acquisition without compensation and the national health insurance and a couple of other nasties that are sitting on Cyril's table at this point in time. But I think what I found quite interesting this week, whether I agree with it or not, and you know, obviously when South Africa decided to take on Israel at the ICC,
ICC.
you know, we all thought, oh God, for God's sake, you know, just, you know, please, you know, go back to sleep, Cyril. You know, what on earth do you think you're doing? But to their credit, they put their best people out there. I don't know if you watched any of it, but they were extremely eloquent. They knew every nuance of the law, and to all intents and purposes, they got their point across. And I think although the stance was obviously deeply unpopular with most of the West, of course it's unpopular with the West, it did paint South Africa in a light that we're not banana republic. We do know what we're talking about. We are still producing some of the best minds that can accredit themselves right across the world. And so I think from that point of view, you know, I was really quite impressed with that. At the end of the day, this is unenforceable. Israel are going to do what they want to do. It's
Have
not
to
going to
do.
make any difference. But I think also, and I say this in the newsletter, I think South Africa's point of view that was going is secretly popular with the Americans and the UK, who are under pressure to reduce the amount of aid that they're giving to Israel. Obviously, and then Hamas and the United Nations goes and shoots themselves in the foot the very next day by confirmation that 12 of their staff were involved in the thing. And it's not supposition and conjecture. They've been fired. So there's fire. There's not just smoke there.
I think this is a high, the topic itself, you know, has got the world divided around, you know, is it right and is it wrong? And I suppose, you know, South Africa is part of that talking point now, which at least puts South Africa, you know, for either the right or wrong reasons back, you know, on the map. But I found the verdict of the ICC, you know, the outcome, I found quite puzzling, Dawn, because in my opinion, firstly, they didn't call it a genocide. They basically told them, you can carry on, but try and bring an end to it, you know. But if you don't mind, just give us an indication in the next 30 days around the following couple of points on how you plan to preserve basically Palestinian lives in the Gaza Strip. Basically, you know, how are you planning to do this? And I think the Israelis must have looked at that verdict and said, okay. So fine. So you're not asking us to stop the war because maybe it's outside of your jurisdiction, so you can't do that. You're not calling it a genocide, so you're stopping from calling it a genocide. Okay, fine. That's fine. And then, quite frankly, the rest of the stuff, which is, you know, don't target civilian hotspots. You know, all of these things. Well, we're doing those things in any case. We just have to now hand a report into the ICC. But will it really, you know, change this at the end of the day? Probably not. I mean, South Africa saw it. I mean, I saw when the verdict got read, I saw people in South Africa calling this an outright win for South Africa. And I thought, that's not an outright win. An outright win is surely if the ICC asked Israel to cease their operation in Gaza and called it a genocide. I mean, that's what South Africa surely wanted at the end of the day. And that, really speaking, didn't happen, right?
I think it was a kind of either side can see it as a win for their side. And it's, I think it further confirms the fact that the ICC is actually, to all intents and purposes, a toothless dog. You know, they can make all these, you know, sit in the ivory tower, make all these lofty things. They're unenforceable. You know, I mean, what, just 18 months ago, they convicted Putin on war crimes for abducting children out of Ukraine. What's happened? Nothing, right?
No, sure.
No,
Nothing
it's,
will
you
happen.
know, it, look, they did have some sort of success with the Rwandan genocide, and that was a proper genocide. They knocked off, you know, 500,000 people in that.
Yeah,
It was
sure.
a proper
Yeah, sure.
genocide. And there are a couple of
Yeah.
people who, you know, I think are sitting in fancy jails, a couple of them in Scotland and this kind of thing. I mean, really. But, you know, I think from our perspective, it put us in a slightly better light to show that your stereotypical African country, as it were.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one thing it has definitely done is I saw the announcement by El Al, which is the Israeli national carrier, and they will cease operations here from March onwards. So goodbye to those dollars that they were bringing, or just, you know, being able to take people between Israel and Johannesburg. That is now gone, you know, for all intents and purposes. You want to go to Israel? You're going to have to, I think, fly through Dubai, basically, in order to try and get there, I'm assuming. And I think there's some flights through Africa as well, up into Ethiopia, and then you could get across into Israel. But those direct flights are something of a, oh, that's something of the past now.
Kobe, the animosity between Israel and the new South Africa post 1994 is well known. Israel was one of the very few countries who ignored the UN sanctions against the previous government. So the animosity is well known. There's very little doubt that Israel helped South Africa build the atom bomb, which has been dismantled since. And that, you know, there is a lot of animosity. And I, you know, I think South Africa, probably given some encouragement by Iran and maybe Hamas and a couple of other less savory actors in order to do this. But, you know, I didn't think they needed much encouragement. They're probably given a bit of money, but, you know, probably not. They didn't need to be sort of goaded into it. You know, I think they were only too happy to stick it to Israel.
No, absolutely. Don't the one thing that I'm seeing kind of going into 2024 is the disarray that the bond markets are in. I mean, 2023 was really a year where the market had to kind of try and find its firm a firmer footing on the back end of this very large inflation number that got printed, and with rates obviously trying to catch that inflation number. And for all intended purposes, this should have had a recession to effect. Now, this might still come. There might still be some form of shallow recession at some point. But much of that has now been discounted in the market, which means that the worst drawdown that I think the market experienced was really on a year-on-year basis, on a, you know, if one looks at a rolling window, would have been kind of somewhere in the beginning part of 2023. That was the worst this is going to be. Now, if you committed capital into equities during that period, you would have done just fine up to this point. Especially if you own something, some of the big tech names, you would have done absolutely fantastic in that process. But going forward, I think there's something underway, which I think is fundamentally important for individuals to understand and for investors to understand. And it's called the great monetization. The world and world governments are awash in debt, and much of that is outstanding debt in bond markets. And those bonds are scattered across yield curves in various countries. Now, the normal operation is when some of those bonds come up for call, that means they mature, you would give back the investors their capital and you would reissue bonds, or you might not reissue bonds. You might say, well, I don't need to reissue bonds. The problem though it has is that the debt numbers that are outstanding are so staggering and so high that the only way to ensure that one can honor this debt is by kicking the can down the road. You're making short-dated bonds long-dated bonds again by rolling them, so to speak. The other way to do it is potentially just to issue new bonds. And this is what is called the great monetization. It's taking this debt and ensuring that governments just continue to roll them forward and forward. Now, remember that much of that activity, Dawn, happens in treasury departments. It doesn't happen at central bank level. Central banks are there for policy certainty and for price security. And they can't create price security if you have a bond market in disarray. So much of this is happening in treasury departments across different economies. Japan's been underway in this for years already. America's about to join. ECB is doing it as we're speaking. And the net effect of this is that as these bonds get rolled forward, yields continue to drop lower, especially if there's a demand for these things. Prices continue to rise in the bond markets. And the people that are paying the price ultimately for this great monetization is retired folk or people that are trying to own bonds. We're talking about pension funds, especially those that are forced to own these bonds. Now, I think that's the backdrop. And governments really have no choice but to do this. They have no choice. How else are you going to repay these levels of debt? How else are you going to do it?
Kobe, one of the things we have talked about quite a lot over the time that we've been doing our podcast is the looming problem of pension funds, particularly in the West. They are defined benefit in most cases, you know, yeah, rather than defined contribution. Are the RAs that we used to, most of the pensions in this country are defined contribution. What you put in is what you get out. But these defined yes. benefit, which is most of these pensions that you find across Europe and across the UK and across the States, they've got huge problems coming down the line because we yeah. are living longer at the end of the day. And our population rates have been plummeting. Most of the West has been below what's called replacement levels for decades, US and everywhere else. And it is causing a huge problem. I mean, Nikki Haley, who is the, I suppose, pretender to Donald Trump, of course, she's not going to win. I doubt she's even going to become vice president. I don't think that Donald Trump would have a woman as a vice president. Mm-hmm. I feel hell of a sorry for her if she did, let alone an yeah. Indian-American. Indian sure. as in an Indian continent. She's only second generation from that. So, I mean, she has said publicly, and it was very unpopular, that in your 20s at the moment, you're going to look at retiring at 70. And, yeah. you know,
and that's true.
And it's true. It was extremely unpopular, yeah. but it's true. That's yeah. why France has had to, they've only increased their pension age by 2 years, but they're doing that for everybody. You know, it's a huge problem. And, you know, when you've got a defined benefit like that, you are forced into using bonds in order to yes. do so because you then have got some sort of certainty. You know, when you've got in defined contribution, you can play around a little bit with the growth side of it, but you can't when you're in that defined benefit field.
Mm. You see, I think governments, you know, who are the people that are promising those defined benefit schemes? It's the governments. The governments are promising those defined benefit schemes. And the people that are promising those defined benefit schemes are the people engaging in this great monetization because they know that the alternative to this is default. And if they default, then there's pain right across the system. You're going to create such upheaval that you won't be able to live with your populace in the same way. So the way in which they're doing it, Dawn, is they're giving the great monetization, they're giving it a name. They're calling it, we're doing this specifically because we're trying to achieve two aims. The first is geopolitical security, because the world is a changed place and they can point to wars happening across the world, et cetera, et cetera. Their own national security is dependent upon this. So that's the first face they give to this thing. And the second thing the second face they give to this is their aging population and making sure that the years that they gave to work for the economy, that they have some retirement, and so to speak, so that they've got some healthcare and so on. And these are burdens that these economies are carrying at the moment. But those are the faces that they've given to these problems. So this great monetization continues, and it will continue for the foreseeable future. The positive out of this is that ultimately it's going to have they have to do something with the capital that they raise because there's new liquidity that they're now pushing into the system. One of the things that I think they're trying to is they're trying to create a new industrialized base, especially Western economies. So Western economies are basically that industrialized base that they gave up to China through the 90s and 80s that they're trying to take back. That industrialization is critically important in order to drive forward the system. That means this is actually quite good news for equities. Equities could actually do quite well. Bonds perhaps would battle in this process, But certainly equities could do incredibly well out of something like this. Ultimately, this could have stagflation to affect down the road. But the question is, will it and when will it? But that's probably a very, very long period away. So I'm expecting, the world is fixated on big tech and AI stocks at the moment, but I'm looking at industrial companies, and I'm saying perhaps industrial companies that know how to put up a building, putting the copper wiring through, through a building, put in a road infrastructure. Perhaps those companies could actually do quite well. And then within that, Dawn, I think India as an emerging market could actually be very well placed for something like this. So usher in 2024. I think it's going to be an interesting year. I think if you are not invested as you are, you probably stand the chance of missing out on some of this. But we'll be talking a lot more about this in 2024, and it's going to be a very, very interesting, it's going to be a very, very interesting time. So thank you for joining us for this inaugural podcast for 2024. A lot more coming from newsletters which we're reading that we're putting together. Point your friends, point your family to the newsletter. We put a ton of work into this every single week. And reach out to us, have a chat to us, and we'll give you feedback. Thank you for listening.